And so, as our theme song fades into the distance, it's time once again for American Hit Radio on 90.3 WHPC. I'm Tom Ryan. Be with you for the next hour. My lovely wife and co-host, Heidi Morales Ryan, here as well.
Come on, everybody.
See, I told you.
There I am.
And, of course, on Fridays, we call the show How Music Changed. We dedicate it to 250 topics that we intend to cover pretty much really the entirety of the history of recorded music. And it's high points anyway. It's it's a stupendously...
it's a huge endeavor.
And yeah, its ambition almost is like absurd. But it's so much fun to do. And we get to learn a lot along the way while we get to share it all with you. Right. We just can't help ourselves. Now, this is part five in our series dedicated to Duke Ellington. And this is going to be incredible, too. I didn't know how many shows this is going to take. But here with show five, we are just into the years 1931, 1932 is what we're going to be covering.
It's like we're just scratching the surface.
And we are only scratching the surface. I mean, I've had the opportunity to play literally at this point in time. He's already made over 200 recordings, maybe 250.
He is prolific.
We're covering maybe 15 or 20% of that in this show.
But what we can.
What's also amazing, though, is that in that short amount of time, in the four shows that we've already done, you could hear a significant growth in his development.
Oh, yeah.
From where he began into where he, where we covered last week when we were talking about his work in Harlem, particularly in the nightclubs of Harlem. But with this show, he once again takes a couple of huge steps. For example, throughout the 20s, jazz music was seen as an untamed, maybe unsophisticated musical style, lacking the decorum and seriousness of the European-based classical styles that preceded it. Duke Ellington was the perfect musician to cast off this yoke.
It was the rock and roll of its day.
Right, right. But like most people who perform rock and roll think that it deserves dignity and respect, Duke absolutely considered that to be the case with jazz music. Ever the gentleman, he brought a significant sense of class to his productions, and it quickly became obvious that in his hands, jazz could be every bit as sophisticated as its precedents. Well, this became even more obvious when Ellington started to compose songs in a longer form that required a 12-inch 78 RPM. Until this point, 12-inch records were almost exclusively dedicated to classical artists, so in a manner that was both subtle and pointed, Ellington introduced jazz as a serious form, fully worthy of the same respect that until now had been relegated solely to classical music. I'm going to set this up by reading an excerpt from a book by Harvey Cohen called Duke Ellington's America. The marketing strategy for Ellington's recordings reflected a striving for quality and respectability and seemed reminiscent of an earlier age in the record industry. The most financially successful record company of the 1910s and 20s, the Victor Talking Machine Company, which became RCA Victor, put major emphasis in their advertising and publicity on music that was good for their general image and also attracted customers to the, quote, better kind, unquote. Victor... Red sealed discs, which were released by Caruso, and concert hall versions of Stephen Foster songs by Alma Gluck sold hundreds of thousands of copies and contributed to the high class image Victor propagated. Premium prices of $2 to $7 were charged for these releases, which was obviously meant that they were intended for a richer clientele. Now, Ellington and his management tried to appropriate the high-class Red Seal aura to jazz and popular recordings. Mirroring classical artists who needed multiple sides to present the entirety of longer classical compositions, Ellington was the first among jazz and popular artists to utilize multi-sided 10-inch 78 RPM recordings to present extended original works, such as the 9-minute Creole Rhapsody in 1931. We're getting there. As Ellington said, we recorded it first on Brunswick and just about got thrown off of the label. We covered that version, by the way. We ended last week's show with that initial version of Creole Rhapsody. The idea of using two sides. The Ellington Band also made an appearance in 1933 on a 12-inch record, a longer disc format rarely used in popular music. The recording, Cotton Club Medley, which we did, again, also covered last week, enlarged the Ellington Orchestra to 24 pieces for the session and was also notable because it was one of the first to feature black and white musicians together. 40 years later, Irving Mills said that he was summoned to the Victor corporate headquarters in Camden, New Jersey, and chastised at a board meeting for, quote, mixing the races on the recording. Uh-huh. His son, Paul Mills, recalled that Victor, quote, fought it only because they were scared. My father had to threaten to take Ellington off the RCA bulletin if they didn't put it out, and they wound up putting it out. The record was a seller. 12-inch records in those days didn't sell like 10-inch records. They were a little harder to produce, and there weren't that many. They were reserved more for classical music than for pop music. So one of the things that Ellington recorded then in this format was Creole Rhapsody. And the first version, which he almost got thrown off of Brunswick for, ran a little bit over 5 minutes. This is the extended version that runs close to 10, nine minutes and change. So let's start and play in its entirety, Creole Rhapsody, the second version on American Net Radio 90.3 WHPC. Thank you. Isn't that beautiful?
Oh, it's sublime.
It's him to listen. I mean, I would say that Louis Armstrong is probably my favorite single musician from the entire 20th century. So I intend no disparagement when I say this. But what Duke is doing here in 1931 is light years away from what Louis was doing.
Yes.
In terms of, like, you know, Louis ended up having that incredible energy and his ebullience and his technical prowess that is just absolutely impossible to beat. But what Ellington is doing here is basically making a lady out of jazz.
I like the way you put that.
I mean, he's just, his melodic themes have become classic. And, you know, what we just heard was literally a composition, something, you know, it's an American jazz version of a song written in classical form.
Right.
So it moves it to a completely different place. And yet, at the exact same time as Ellington is doing that, he's performing at the Cotton Club with regularity, writing songs that are intended pretty much exclusively for his live performances at the Cotton Club. Mm-hmm. And he's doing that in the format that is being expected of him.
Hey, play for your audience.
For example, you know, here's this next song, which was exactly him doing that, I'm sure, Heidi, playing for his audience. It's called Echoes of the Jungle on American Hit Radio 90.3 WHPC. It's not even a song that's particularly famous.
No.
And yet it's just, it's stunning and fascinating at the quality of its writing and of its structure.
Yeah, it's got a lot going on.
At this point in time, you can hear already how Ellington is writing for the personalities of his band. He knows what their styles are like. So he'll write things that basically play to their strengths. And the band at this time, his quote-unquote Cotton Club Orchestra, was stunning. Just, these are the musicians that we just heard on that track called Echoes of the Jungle. Three trumpet players, Arthur Wetzel, Cootie Williams, and Freddie Jenkins, who could play, you know, basically play sweet. Cootie could do that growl, and Ellington knew it and, you know, wrote for it. On trombone, Joe Nanton and Juan Tizol. The New Orleanian, Barney Bogard, on clarinet, sometimes on tenor sax. Johnny Hodges, also on sax or clarinet. Harry Carney, also on clarinet, or alto or baritone sax, quite the section. Freddie Guy would play banjo to help keep the beat going, with Wilman Broud playing bass and the drummer Sonny Greer playing drums, while, of course, Duke handled all the piano parts and the songwriting and the structure and putting that all together. Pretty amazing. Let's now just do something simple. Just a little fun thing. Duke, in his own book, which he called Music is My Mistress, had little blurbs about various people in his life at that given time. And here's a section of what he had written about Sonny Greer. Every young drummer who ever saw Sonny Greer in his heyday was awed and inspired by his equipment, and the pros still talk about it. There were chimes, gongs, timpani, cymbals, it seemed, by the dozen, tom-toms, snare drums, and bass drums, enough to equip the whole percussion section of a symphony. It was not only ornamental, for he used to get some crazy effects. Greer was not the world's best reader of music, but he was the world's best percussionist reactor. When he heard a ping, he responded with the most apropos pong. Any tune he was backing up had the benefit of rhythmic ornamentation that was sometimes unbelievable. And he used to look like a high priest or a king on a throne, way up above everybody, with all his gold accessories around him and all there was room for on the stand.
Wow.
So there you go. Here's another track from this exact era. This one is called It's Glory. On AmericanNet Radio, 90.3 WHPC. Thank you. another classic sleeper from an era. I mean, do these songs sound like they're 90 years old to you? I mean, to me, there's an incredible freshness about them. Something that almost, it retains its sparkle after all this. Much like Lewis's music, but for a very different reason. There's an incredible deliberation about what Duke is doing, which is in stark contrast to the liberating freedom that Lewis gave you, made you feel. And those two things at the same time, pretty much, I think, is what gave jazz the longevity that it had. If it wasn't for both of those elements, the deep thinking Ellington and the freedom loving expressionism of Lewis, I think that those are the things that gave jazz its strength and its power. And to this day, I think some of the best jazz ever made came from those two musicians. Now, let's look at another artist from Ellington's band around this time. Trumpeter Arthur Wetzel is the next one that we can read about, a little bit of an excerpt about from Ellington's book, Music is My Mistress. As a trumpet player, he had a tonal personality that has never really been duplicated. Sweet, but not syrupy, nor schmaltzy, nor surrealistic. It had a superiority of extrasensory dimensions. He's so florid in his words.
Both he must really like that player.
Right? Both as a soloist and from the point of view of teamwork, he was a fine musician. Everything with him had to be of the best, and he was one of the really good readers. He left us to go back to Howard University to study medicine. Although he loved his music, I think he felt called upon to pursue a career that was considered in those days more respectable. Bubba Miley took his place, but he returned to the band several times during summer vacations. As the band grew bigger, we first used two and then three trumpets, so there was always a chair for Arthur Wetzel until he had to retire because of illness in 1937. He was one of those who could have had the shirt off my back had he needed it. He left behind an echo of oral charisma that I can still hear. Here's another classic but sleeper track from around this era. Keep in mind that Duke is not only, by the way, making this impression in New York City at the Cotton Club, but he's being broadcast across the entire United States, nationally, of course, and also overseas. So his records are selling well in places like France and such. And often he would do two recordings. He would have an American version and a French version of the same track. This happens to be from the French RCA version of a track called The Mystery Song on American Net Radio, 90.3 WHPC. Thank you. Another great track that by playing it today, it's trying to basically salvage it from the hands of time. So much great stuff from Ellington at this era. Let's read one more short autobiographical summary from Ellington's book, Music Is My Mistress, this time about his trombonist Juan Taizal. Juan was born in San Juan, Puerto Rico, and suitably named after the saint, San Juan. He studied and mastered every instrument in the orchestra, but finally settled down to specialize on the valve trombone. He came to Washington, D.C. about 1920 in Marie Lucas's orchestra and played the Howard Theater and the TOBA circuit. When we decided to add a valve trombone, Wetzel took the responsibility of convincing him to come and join us at the Cotton Club in 1929. He was a tremendous asset to our band, managed his finances well, and in 1941, bought some property in Los Angeles, which he later sold at a handsome profit. Soon he wanted to stay in Los Angeles, and everything went well until his wife, Rosebud, a Washington girl and a splendid cook, got sick. When it became really serious and she was hospitalized, he buried his horn in a closet and stayed home rather than gamble on playing his music and running the risk of losing his wife. He could watch over her and be at her side whenever she might need help or a word of prayer, or someone to call the doctor. Great sense of character there. Let's play one more of these somewhat sleeper songs that I think are just still outrageously fantastic. From 1932 now, this track is called Moon Over Dixie on 90.3 WHPC.
Tell Louisiana that I'm blue tonight. Moon over Dixie, keep shining bright. Look for Louisiana, you'll know Louisiana by those fields of white. There's a cabin in the cotton that never will be forgotten, where I'd give the world to be once more. You might think that you're in heaven, but you haven't been in heaven till you creep inside that cabin door. Oh, moon over Dixie, it don't seem right. You're in Louisiana, I miss Louisiana, that's why I'm so blue tonight. ¶¶
Since we were speaking of Sonny Greer earlier, I should mention that that was actually Sonny Greer on vocals on that track. Showing his own sense of sophistication. This time it's not Irving Mills, but literally it's the drummer doing the vocal on that song. Now we have an honest to goodness hit. A song that Duke composed in 1932. Lyrics appended by Irving Mills, his manager. It's obviously a jazz standard, legendary jazz standard, called It Don't Mean a Thing If It Ain't Got That Swing. I mean, everybody knows that title, right? I mean, in a way, the title itself was, you know, prophetic. And Ellington credited the saying as the credo of trumpeter Bubber Miley, who at this point in time was dying of tuberculosis. In fact, he died the same year that this song was released. So we dedicate this to the memory of Bubber Miley on American Net Radio 90.3 WHPC. Here's It Don't Mean a Thing If It Ain't Got That Swing.
What da do?
Was Ivy Anderson on lead vocals. I think it's the first time we're hearing her voice in our series. And I think it would be fair to say that she was the first great vocalist that Ellington really worked with, and maybe the best. I don't think that Duke was particularly lucky in terms of being able to get vocalists who became incredible superstars in their own right. But Ivy Anderson is probably the one who comes closest in terms of being able to present an interpretable, dedicated version, you know, emotionally to what she brought to the, she brought something to the material on It Don't Mean a Thing, It Ain't Got That Swing. Now, one thing that Duke also recognized around this time was that these compositions that he was writing had a tremendous amount of financial value that he ought to be able to try to figure out how to capitalize on. And like we started our show with him playing long form version of a track that he wrote, you know, a new track that he wrote called Creole Rhapsody, it occurred to him that he could put out 12-inch records of him performing medleys of some of his best material that he would figure out, he would rearrange and string it together. And it was very successful in terms of sales, which is, again, unusual for jazz on a 12-inch record format, but it also helped with the reputation of jazz. So we're going to end our show now with Duke performing two different medleys of his material. The first, including Mood Indigo, Hot and Bothered, and Creole Love Call, followed by another medley of East St. Louis Toodaloo, a piano break called Lot of Fingers, and then Black and Tan Fantasy. Thanks, folks. Hope you enjoyed the show. It's been a real pleasure to bring it to you, and we'll be back next week with part 6. Be well. Have a great weekend.
Mm-hmm.